That's on Kappa. It's part of a prayer that he made at an ancient monastery in Tibet in 1402.
What is it? A parody?
Excuse me?
It's a part of what?
An ancient poem. A poem that he wrote. It was part of a request he made. He was making a request in front of an ancient statue of a great master. And he went into a one-month LSD trip. he went into this hallucinations for a whole month. Seeing all the lineage lamas blessing him to do some great work. And then he came out of it and he wrote the Lama Rinpoche, which is the greatest book ever written in Tibet. So this is from the source of all my good, which some of you have. And this describes what you should do in order to take the Bodhisattva Das. He's describing what you should do. The verse before it described how to get the motivation to take the Bodhisattva Das, how to get the motivation of wanting to reach enlightenment to help other people. And then it goes into what you should do after that, which is where we've reached. Next class we'll start the actual Bodhisattva Das, describing them, looking at what they are, looking at what they're not. But tonight it's sort of what's the whole structure of the Bodhisattva Das? How do they fit into your whole Buddhist career in your life? And Jetsun Kapa says, please repeat, okay? Semtam.
Semtam.
Kekyam.
Kekyam.
Suchim.
Suchim.
Namsum La.
Namsum La.
Semtam. Semke means bodhicitta. It's the wish to help all living beings. Sam means just that. Just that. By the way, it won't be a sentence until we reach the end, so don't worry. Kyang means but. Suchim means morality. Namsum La means the three types. So what does it mean so far? It doesn't mean anything. Semtan Kekyang means you may be able to get the emotion in your heart that you'd like to help all living beings. You may be able to get to the point where you have that emotion. Semtan Kekyang. But Suchim Namsum La say Komba.
Komba.
Mena.
Mena.
Chanchu. Mindupar.
Mindupar.
Okay. Komba Mena means, but if you don't get very good, if you don't get very good at the three types of morality, Namsumla, okay, if you don't get very, very, if you don't become a great master of these three types of morality, Namsumla, Chanchu Mindupa. Chanchu Mindupa means you will not become a Buddha. You will not reach enlightenment. Okay. So he says, you may get this wish to become a Buddha for all sentient beings. You may reach that point where you actually feel that emotion. But if you don't go out and become very good at those three moralities, you're not going to reach Buddhahood. You cannot. We'll talk about what the three moralities are. That's the whole point of this tonight's class. Okay. Now say Lekpar.
Lekpar.
Tone.
Tone.
Gyase.
Gyase.
Dombala.
Dombala.
Okay. Lekpar Tone means realize it. You must realize this. Lekpa Tongli means you must realize this. You must realize that you can't become enlightened if you don't become very good at the three types of morality, even though you may want to be a Buddha to help all people. Lekpa Tongli, Gyalse Dombala. Gyalse means bodhisattvas. Gyalse. Dombala means the vows. The vows of a bodhisattva. The bodhisattva vows. Dombala. Now say Tsumba.
Tsumba.
Chakbu.
Chakbu.
Oh, this is wimpy. Come on.
Tsumba. Tsumba.
Chakbu.
Chakbu.
Lopa.
Lopa.
Jingi Lop.
Jingi Lop.
Okay. Tsumba Chakbu means fierce efforts. Okay. Fierce efforts. Mighty efforts. We don't know about what yet. Lopa means train yourself. Train yourself. Lopa means train yourself. And Jingi Lop means he's asking his own lamas, please bless me. Please bless me. So what it means, by the way, Tibetan is backwards compared to English, okay? The sentence order is backwards. So Jetsun Kapa is saying, he's in this vision, and he's got hundreds of lamas in front of him, and he's saying, please bless me to be able to train myself with fierce efforts in the vows of the Bodhisattva. So what it means is, he's advising us also, it's sort of advice also. You must realize that you can't become enlightened if you don't practice the three kinds of morality, even though you may have this golden intention. And therefore, we ask our lamas to bless us, that we can train ourselves with mighty efforts in the Bodhisattva vows. And that's a fact. You know, you study the Bodhisattva vows. Those people here who've studied the proof of past lives and future lives, and the people who've gone through the karma course, and the people who've gone through the emptiness course, you realize that you must do some kind of powerful good deeds to reach enlightenment. And you understand that the process very clearly. Buddhahood is empty. Karma projects onto it. Karma is collected in your mind, which is endless and beginningless. We proved all that. We went through all that. Now, what kind of deeds do you have to get to project the right things onto this empty thing? What kind of good deeds do you have to do? Three moralities. Three moralities. We're going to go through the three moralities right now. It's not as boring as the morality sounds in English, okay? You could say spiritual code or something like that. It's not like not having a good time or something like that. All right? It's more fun than that. Say nature. Dombe.
Dombe.
First kind of morality, okay? Sutra means morality. We always start from the back, okay? Sutra means morality. By the way, you don't have to know the Tibetan on your homework and stuff like that. It's just that if you hear it enough, you'll start to turn on to it, and then you can start to study it. I think everyone in the Tibetan course, is about 20 people there, started just like this. They didn't have any intention to learn Tibetan. And some of them are translating now. They're really doing well. So if you hear it often enough, you start to understand it, and then you start wanting to do it. Domba means to restrain. Dombe means to restrain. Nature means bad deeds. Bad deeds. So the first kind of morality is the kind of morality that you think of when I say morality in English. Okay? It's the morality of holding yourself back, of controlling yourself, and not doing bad deeds. There's more or less two definitions of a bad deed in Buddhism. What do you think it is? Do you remember from the karma?
Something that causes a bad result.
For you.
Yeah, the definition of bad karma is any deed which you do which brings you suffering. That's the definition of bad karma. Bad karma in Buddhism is defined as any deed which you do which ultimately brings you suffering through a karmic ripening. That's the definition of a bad deed in Buddhism. There's another definition, which is a shenu shida chepale, loba de anunale sukuchi yin shek debe dampo e sapu ki chapa, sabun de che yino shek, kube tsuni nabe, which means, basically bad karma is anything that hurts other people. And those are the same thing. Those are two qualities of bad karma. They hurt other people and yourself. They make you unhappy. They bring you suffering. That's an interesting definition of a bad deed. It's not that God is unhappy with you, or you offend some tradition, or it's against the rules, and we don't know why. It's just that it will bring you suffering. That's the definition of bad karma. So the first kind of morality is to avoid those things. You can basically divide those into two categories. What's the most basic division of Buddhist morality? Of the type of avoiding bad deeds. Roughly. I mean, there's 84,000 bad deeds you can do. And in the Abhidhamma Kosha it says, let's make it simple. We'll put the top 10. Okay? We'll get it down to the top 10. Three in your body. Three that you do with your body. Four that you do with your mouth. And then three that you do in your mind. Okay. What are the three in body?
Killing.
I'll make it short. Killing meaning taking the life of any living being. Not just murder of a human, but taking the life of any human, any living being. And number two?
Stealing.
Generally the limit is 10 cents.
What? Come on.
There's a limit to it?
Anything over 10 cents that you... Because of you, somebody else has put out by more than 10 cents. Broken the second one. So if you can make a 9-cent phone call and work, it's okay.
Is this index for inflation from the Buddhist time? I said, did you adjust that for inflation from the Buddhist time?
Oh, yeah, no. third one?
Sexual misconduct.
Sexual misconduct. For everyone, it's adultery. There's other kinds of sexual misconduct, like having sex in front of a Buddha image or some things like that. Having sex with your mother or your sister, things like that. For a monk, any kind of sex like that. Depends on what your level is. Okay, number four. Those are the three of speech, of a body. It's not the four of speech. What are they?
Lying,
number one. Lie. Technically defined as giving anyone a false impression. It's just about puts me out of business. I mean, in my other business. Okay. Number five. Divisive talk. We don't have a good word in English, but it's where by hinting or directly, you try to separate two other people. Did you hear what she said about you the other day? It can be a lie or it can be the truth. Either one. Okay, even if it's the truth. It doesn't apply to trying to protect people. If you say, look, I happen to know that he's plotting to murder you tomorrow at 3 o'clock, that's okay. That's not divisive talk. Divisive talk is like trying to alienate other people who are friends, or if they're enemies, you try to split them further. Okay, any kind of separation there of other people. That's divisive talk. Number six?
Harsh
words. Harsh words can be very soft, nice words that are meant to hurt someone deeply. Sometimes you can say a very harsh thing that it's to your friend and they know you mean it in good, in happy way, and it's not harsh speech. Okay? Harsh speech is when you say something with the intention that it cuts somebody, whether it's gentle or harsh.
What about if your intention is not to hurt the person, but it hurts?
You collect part of a bad deed. Like when I joke, you mean?
Mm-hmm. I do that.
You studied that.
Oh, I knew that.
Number seven. Idle talk. Wasting time talking. Wasted talk. Then the three, those are four that are done in with your speech. These three are done with your body. How about the three of your mind, which are the most powerful? First one?
Being glad when someone fails.
That's number nine. What's the first one? Yeah. How are we avoiding these things?
Covetous.
Huh?
Covetousness.
Craving. Okay, coveting. Coveting is, by the way, if there's 84,000 of these, and these are the top 10, we must be doing it all day long. You know? Who's made it, you know, if there's 83,990 that didn't make it, we're probably doing these all the time. So coveting means, you know, it could be another person's position at work, it could be another person's wife or husband, it could be another person's good looks or intelligence, it could be their money. It could be anything that they have that you wish that you had, in a bad way. You know, if you see a llama and you admire a good quality and you wish you were like that, that's not coveting. Coveting is where, basically jealousy, it's very related to jealousy. Now that you've had this class, you can't have it anymore, because you're bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas swear to live so that other people can have even the slightest pleasures. So anytime someone else gets something good from now on, you have to be happy. Even if you don't like them at work. Okay. Number nine.
Giving up the aspirations for
bodhicitta.
Giving up the aspirations for bodhicitta.
No. Ill will. What do you call it? We'll call it ill will, okay? But what it means is being happy when someone else gets hurt. Basically. Taking some kind of pleasure out of other people's misfortunes. If you watch yourself, you'll see you have it all the time. Now, someone you don't like at work gets yelled at by the boss, and you're kind of like, oh, sorry. You do it all the time. We do it all the time. I had it today. Wrong view. There's basically two or three important ones. One would be, for example, to believe that you cannot reach perfection in this life. You cannot reach paradise in this life. To really, in your back of your heart, believe that before you die, you can't reach a state of total perfection. It's a very serious wrong view. You can, and that's the purpose of studying. And you just got to move your rear end. Do it. But the other classic one is that karma is not true, which means I understand that if I do a bad deed in front of somebody who respects me, or I'll get a bad reputation, or I understand that if I cheat on my taxes and I'm not very clever about it, they're going to catch me and I'll get some bad result. But if I could do a bad deed in the privacy of my own room, or on the street when none of my Buddhist friends are around me, if I could do a karma that I could get away with it, it would be all right. I would not get a karmic result. Everything would be all right. I can think bad thoughts as long as I don't show it to other people. That's all a very bad wrong view. Why is it the most serious wrong view? I mean, the most serious of the ten. It's a good reason to do the other nine. When you get a good opportunity, okay, when no one's around, right? It's the very worst of all of them. Because it will allow you to do the other nine. It's a misperception. How is karma collected? We just talked about it. Simba, Lenny.
By your perception and your mind.
When you see yourself do a bad deed, when you're aware of yourself thinking a bad thought, the karma is collected thereby. That's the process by which the karma is planted. That's the process by which the karma is stored. So you're in trouble. It doesn't matter who's watching or who knows. If you know, it's collected. The karma is planted by your perception of the karma. So you can't escape. You have to be good. Okay. So those are that's the first big division of this kind of, yeah.
Yeah, but do animals not get calmer since they don't know what they're doing?
They get less by not knowing what they're doing. But they do have a perception of themselves hurting other beings. That's what I mean. It doesn't have to necessarily be an understanding that they're hurting. Some people said, does that mean Hitler's karma was not so bad? Because he truly felt he was doing a good thing, maybe. It is much less than if he had... if he hadn't had that delusion. Okay? It's interesting. Okay. The second kind of Nyecha Dombe Tsuchun is what we call, say, Sotaki.
Sotaki.
Domba.
Domba.
Sotaki.
Sotaki.
Domba.
Domba.
Sota is, in Sanskrit, is pratimoksha. Pratimoksha means vowed morality, where you take a vow to keep your morality. Domba means vow. So Sotaki Domba means the vows of morality, the Buddhist vows of morality. There are eight types. There are eight kinds. A full monk, fully ordained monk. Gelong, Bhikshu. 253 vows. Full nun, 364 vows.
Why are they more for nuns?
It was inevitable.
I don't know why. They're much different. I mean, their vows are much different. I mean, there's a lot of things related to being a woman that, you know, woman's body and stuff like that. You know, they're both things that they care for. There's a lot like that. There's a vow called an intermediate nun. Get a little more.
How many vows for the intermediate?
I was afraid you asked me that. I don't want to say. Let me check in. I believe it's 12 on top of the 36. But, these two ordinations don't exist anymore in the Tibetan tradition. They were broken. So we don't even, you know, it's a long story. We'll do the full nun and the intermediate nun. Those two vows, there were not enough nuns at a certain point in Tibetan history to ordain new nuns, and it broke. You cannot make a new nun in the Tibetan tradition right now, full nun. All the nuns you meet are novice nun. Okay. Novice monk, novice nuns, 30-something vows, 36. These are ordained people. These are people who've sworn to give up the family life. They have to wear robes. They have to live in a monastery normally. These are people who've become ordained. Okay, the other three are are for lay people. These are normally 5 vowels each. Be nice if you could take them sometime. And then there's a 1-day vowel for men or women, which is similar to the 1-day bodhisattva vowel we sometimes take. It's a little bit different. Basically, you try to live like an ordained person for 1 day. You know, you don't eat afternoon, you don't have any sexual relations for that day, you don't eat meat if you take the bodhisattva one, and things like that. You don't sing or dance the whole day, you don't wear jewelry. You know, things like that. For 1 day, you try to act as if you were a monk. In other countries like Thailand, in the Far East, there are variations of these vows. But these aren't, you know, in Thailand, you can become a monk for 2 months or 3 months. And the king did it, for example. It's not in the Vinaya. It's not really one of the vows in the classical original Buddhism. Those are like local variations that sprung up. They would not be recognized in the Vinaya as vows. These are all there are. Sometimes, like on your homework, it says, name the 7 vows of the Sota, of the Patimoksha. That's because when you're talking about bodhisattva vows, normally you have to have one of the first 7 vows here. Okay, it's best if you can take your bodhisattva vows after you've taken one of the first 7 vows here. It's not necessary that you have one of those vows. It's best if you do, but it's not necessary. You can take the bodhisattva vows if you are just keeping these 10 pretty well. If you intend to keep these 10 pretty well, you can take the bodhisattva vows. It's best if you have one of the first 7 vows over there.
6 or 7.
This just means a man who swears to keep those 5 for his whole life. And this is a woman who swears to keep those 5 for her life. Same vow. The vows are the same. They count them differently. They count them separately, men and women, in the Vinaya. Yeah.
You said you act like as if you are a nun or as if you are a monk. You don't dance, you don't sing, you don't do.
Yeah.
Why not? What's behind
that? We have to study Vinaya for that. And we can sometime if you want. We will study some tonight. But in general, a monk in a monastery or a nun is supposed to live a contemplative life, a quiet, meditational life. And that would tend to make you a little bit, if you've ever like meditated for a month or two and then you wouldn't dance. You know, it's just that your mind is at a certain calm level, where you wouldn't, even music would disturb it very much. Just to hear a song, it disturbs your meditation very much. So it's just that it would lead you, it might lead you to be a little careless with your other dogs. You have to dance with somebody, right? Things like that. But that's a long story. The Vinaya text, there's 16 volumes, 16,000 pages. We'll get into it, okay? There's a good reason for all of them. They're very, very beautiful. They're not meant to be restrictive or repressive, or they actually liberate you. But you have to be in the mood to study it.
The difference, like, you don't have the names for the days, but what distinguishes the days?
It's a good question. Here, you have vowed for your life to keep those vows. All of these vows are lifetime, except for the 1-day vow. You can't give it up in this life. If you take it, any of these vows, not intending to keep it until the day you die, they don't even form in your mental stream. You can walk around with the robes on for 20 years, but if in your heart, when you took them, you didn't intend to keep them until you died, they don't form. And there's other details like that.
What do you mean they don't form?
You don't have the vows. They actually don't form in your being. You know, if you take your monk's vows and your reason for taking them is something like looking good or escaping a debt that you have or things like that. They don't even form in your being. You don't have the vows. You never did. It's very, if you take the monk's vows and don't intend to keep all of them, if there's one or two that you have a problem with and you don't really believe in them, they don't form in them. It's very interesting. It's a big detail. We'll get into it someday.
But they do form bad karma.
Excuse me?
They do
perform with that karma. I mean, the form sees the little effect later. Right? Because you're effectively faked about, you're effectively lying, which is one of the things...
Partly. If you intend to break them before you die, if you intend to give them up before you die, you've lied. You know, during the ceremony, you have to swear that you intend to keep them. These you don't. These 10 are just... Everyone has to keep them. It doesn't matter if you're Buddhist or not. Really. Okay? So that's Nyenche Dombe Tsuchu.
So A is the... just kind of...
Yeah.
Things to watch out
They call
for.
It general Buddhist morality. Everyone has to keep
general
them.
Buddhist morality.
And these are vowed morality. And we'll get into the advantages of vowing to do something rather than just doing it. Say, Gewe.
Gewe.
Shuduki.
Shuduki.
Shujin.
Shujin.
Shujin means morality again. Gewe Chudu means the morality of collecting goodness. The morality of collecting goodness. That again is two different kinds. Two different divisions. What are the six perfections of a bodhisattva? Giving. Okay. I like to use giving rather than generosity. For example, teaching someone equanimity is one of the highest acts of giving, of the first perfection. It's not kind of generosity, I would think. You know? It doesn't mean being easy with your money.
Equanimity?
Yeah. That teaching someone that is one of the highest forms of giving. It's right in this category. That's why I don't like the word generosity. I prefer giving. Okay, number two.
Morality.
Number
three.
Yeah, number three, we don't have... Fran did it nice way. We don't have a good word in English. It means not getting angry when you should get angry. It means when the poop hits the fan and you're just about to get angry, you back off. That's the third perfection. I don't know if we have a good word in English. Patience is okay. Patience is close. Some people say forbearance.
Self-restraint.
Self-restraint can be not killing people and stuff like that.
Tolerance.
Keeping your cool.
Tolerance.
You could say tolerance, in a way.
Okay. Watchfulness.
What's that?
Watchfulness. Watchfulness or
vigilance? You have to be watchful to keep it. It comes before that. We'll say patience, but you know what I mean. Okay. We'll say not getting angry.
Not getting angry, but what?
Any kind of not getting angry. If you stub your toe and get angry, you broke it. Okay. It can be aimed at inanimate and animate objects. If you get all hot while you're waiting for a bus because it's late, you broke it. Seriously. Okay. You broke it. Why? The bus is late because you did bad karma in the past. Seriously. Being angry at it is going to make the next bus late for you. That's a long story. We'll skip to number five. What's that?
Concentration.
Okay, concentration or maybe you can say meditation. The ability to meditate. And then number six?
Wisdom.
What happened to number four?
You left it out.
Joyful effort.
Huh?
Joyful effort.
Yeah, joyful effort. It means effort. It goes on both sides.
What are the two sides again?
We didn't get to that yet. Effort doesn't mean working hard at work. Effort is defined as gela to'o, which means enjoy doing good deeds. You get high off doing nice things. Okay, that's the definition of effort. Tsum kan gela to'o, Shantideva's definition. So, these are two great divisions of this kind of morality. Okay. It's called the morality of collecting goodness because if you collect it together, all these things, if you're able to do them and collect together the energy you get from them, they make you a Buddha. They turn you into a Buddha. We give you the two parts of a Buddha. This is called... these are the categories. These happen to, incidentally, give you the physical body of a Buddha. Mainly, these create the physical body of the Buddha, which could look like Tara, could look like green Tara, could look like the Dalai Lama. You know, depends on what you'd like to look at. Anything you want, okay? And the wisdom side is, what would you guess?
The mind.
Yeah. These are the causes to make you omniscient. You'd be able to see every object in the universe at the same instant. You know what's going on at Mars. You know what's going on planet Earth. You know what's going on 10,000 years from now in so-and-so's mind, all at the same moment. That's a mind of a Buddha. Those are the causes. So, it's interesting. This doesn't have much to do with morality, does it? In the sense of what you think of morality. This is really just doing good things to collect together some kind of great energy so that you yourself can become a Buddha. That's a second kind of morality. It doesn't have anything to do with morality. Except for, you know, this little one here. But it's not what you would think of as a kind of morality, meaning not to do bad things. It's really just collecting together huge karmic energies in order to change yourself into an enlightened being. That's the second kind of morality. Third kind of morality, then we'll take a break.
And what would you call it, Michael? What would be
I call it the morality of collecting goodness. Because that's what they call it. But it's really just the actions that you have to do to turn yourself into an enlightened being. Say, Semjen.
Semjen.
Dun Jegi. Sutjin means morality, again, third kind of morality. Semjen Dun Jegi means working for the good of other beings. It's the morality of working for the good of other beings. Working for others. The morality of working for all living beings. It's the same thing as the first two moralities. So why bother to make a third? Yeah, precisely. Precisely. It has to do with why you're keeping those moralities. In the third kind of morality, you're doing this. You're doing the other two moralities, but you're doing it for the sake of other beings. It's a difference in motivation. It's exactly the same actions. It's avoiding bad deeds, and it's collecting good energy, karmic energy. But in the third case, you're doing it for the sake of other people. You're doing it to help other people. It's exactly the same kind of morality as the other two. I'll cheat and I'll give you one more point.
What would you call it?
I promised you a break. The morality of working for others. The morality of working for all living beings? How's that? We could put here as an example the three types of vows. And I don't want you to get confused between the three types of morality and the three types of vows. Now we're going to talk about the three types of vows. We covered the three types of morality. Here's one example of those three kinds of morality. Okay? What's the first type of vows? Those pratimoksha. Those eight types of vows that I just put up, those lifetime vows. That's the first kind. So you can say, basically those eight types of vows that I already put up. Vowing that till the end of your life, you will keep these vows. Except in the eighth case, which is a one-day vow. That's the first level of vow, of Buddhist vows. Okay. What's the second level of Buddhist vows? Bodhisattva vows.
Michael, does this come under the morality of working for the good of the others?
It's included in there, but it's not exhausted. There's other kinds of morality. This covers all valid morality of a Buddhist. Anything you can take a vow about is in one of those three. These are the Bodhisattva. The flavor of these vows is much, much different. You know, the flavor of the first kind of valid morality is very much, I will not hurt other people. And you know that from those ten. But the flavor of the Bodhisattva vows is, I will not be selfish. I will take care of others. That's the whole flavor of the Bodhisattva vows. I will watch out for other people, and I will not be selfish. I will be considerate of others. I will live my whole life being considerate of others and not be selfish. That's the main flavor of the Bodhisattva vows. What's the third kind?
The secret.
Tantric vows. I can't tell you the secret vows, because they're secret. But I can tell you the flavor of them. And that's that... There are certain kinds of attitudes and activities, behavior, that if you keep it very carefully, you can become enlightened within this life. You can reach the highest level of bliss and paradise in this very life, if you keep those things. And if you mess up in any of those very, very karmically nuclear bomb categories, it will harm you immensely. tantric vows all center around that thing. There are certain objects, certain activities, certain attitudes that if you study them carefully and keep them carefully, you can become enlightened in this life before you die. You can reach a Buddhist body and mind in this life. And if you take them on and then break them, you can have equally horrible results. That's the flavor of the secret vows. They're very powerful and very important. Each one of these is built on the last, and we'll talk about that after the break. Not killing people, and not killing people and keeping a vow to not kill people. There's a difference between vowing to do something and just doing it because you're in a good mood or something like that. Okay? And we're going to explain that the advantage of taking a vow to do something, vow morality, rather than just keeping your morality because you enjoy it or because you think it's the right thing to do or something that, like that. It's supposed to be much more powerful to take a vow not to do certain things, or to take a vow to do certain things and then not do them or do them, than it is just to avoid doing it because you feel like it or you think it's a nice idea or something like that. In other words, taking a vow has four distinct advantages. And we're going to talk about the advantages of taking a vow rather than just doing it. I mean, a lot of people you might meet, they say, those are nice, those bodhisattva vows are nice. But I do most of that stuff already. It's much more powerful and much more, it's some kind of distinction if you vow, if you take the vow. And I repeat that if you're in this class, you do not have to take those vows. Just learning what they are. If you never take them, it's okay. Be very beautiful if you take them. Be much more powerful. Why? Here's the first reason. Taken from somebody else. What this means is, and we'll cover this next class, when you take the bodhisattva vows, you have to take them from a person who has certain qualities. One of the qualities is that, for example, they should be keeping the bodhisattva vows very well themselves. They should know them very well. And then there are other qualities that we'll cover next class. The great advantage of taking them from someone else is a mental function, one of the 50-something mental functions in Buddhism, called Nota.
Someone who knows them well and keeps them, or?
Yep. It says not enough if the guy is smart and knows all the, you know, he knows all the scriptures, but he doesn't keep them. You shouldn't take your vows from him or her. But we'll get into that next week. Say chayu.
Chayu
is one of the mental functions. It's defined as, and you can name it what you want, we'll talk about it. It's defined as when you're close to committing a bad deed, you pull back. And you stop yourself because you're embarrassed about what other people might think. Open the floor for suggestions on the translation. Some people say consideration. Some people say shame, but shame. I use shame in the reading. Okay,
shame.
It's restraint because you're embarrassed that someone else might see you.
It's based on another's reaction.
It's based on another person's reaction rather than your own.
It's like an image morality.
Yeah. Self-image morality. Reputation morality. And taking a vow has that advantage. Because you went to some person, some great lama, like the Dalai Lama or Ken Rinpoche, and you said, I beg you to give me these vows. And he says, can you keep them? And you say, I swear I'll keep them. He says, okay, I'll give them to you. He gives them to you. You know, and this is my situation. I live with him. You know, so I can't break those vows. He's around me all the time. You know? And that's the whole point. You would be very embarrassed, particularly if the person who gave you those vows learned that you had broken them. So taking them from somebody else, the act of going to someone and taking a vow helps you keep that morality. That's one advantage of a vow. You have to take a vow from somebody else. And you're very embarrassed to break that vow, and then this holy lama would find out about it. Ken Rinpoche would find out that you broke your bodhisattva vows.
Well, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Not at all. No, it happens to be one of the kinds of armor. It's one of the kinds of protections for your morality. Maybe it's not such a noble intention. I think it was some kind of, was it Plato or somebody? he saw a boy, and the boy did something wrong, and the boy blushed, and he said, the blush is the sign of your morality, you know. It's a great sign. It's a great deed that you just did by blushing. It means you're embarrassed to do something wrong. You don't want to do something wrong in front of somebody else, particularly if you went and begged them for these vows, you know, and then they find out that you broke them. And that's happened to me. I've made personal commitments to tell Rinpoche if I broke a certain thing that I had trouble with. And then it was very hard to break it, because I knew I would have to go tell him. He's this old, severe, you know, Tibetan Lama, and it's very embarrassing to sit there and, you know, you're trying to beat around the bush, and finally he figures out what you're trying to say. You did that? I said, yeah. He doesn't even want to see you, you know. It's very bad. So it's very... It works. It really works. It works. Take it from somebody else. What's the other one? By the way, this is not a translation of this. Okay?
Right. That was the mistake.
It's just that because you took the vows from somebody else, you have this capacity for being embarrassed or ashamed, which protects your vows.
You said that was one of the... How many,
it's they're called the four benefits of vows. Okay?
No, the 12.
Yeah, it's one of the 50-something mental functions. Depends on which school you're in. Abhidharma school has 40-something. Self-Trantika school has 50-something. Pure motivation, it's called. Pure motivation means when you take your vows, on the day that you take your bodhisattva vows and you're kneeling in front of that lama, and he goes through all the preliminaries, then he says, okay, you're just about to get your vows. When I snap your fingers, my fingers, you have the vows. The vows enter your mind stream. Then you repeat a certain thing 3 times, and then he says, snap his finger, and then you're supposed to get toblo. Toblo means, I got it. It's the realization that you got the vows, that they've now entered your mind stream. Bodhisattva vows never go away. Pratimoksha vows die when they go away when you die, or when you give them up. Okay, like a monk's vows, the moment you die, you lose those vows. Bodhisattva vows are not like that. They stay with you forever, unless you consciously do something to give them up. But they stay. They are not destroyed by death. They stay in your mental stream. So here's this person, you're kneeling before him or her, and they give you your vows. At that moment, you're supposed to have this motivation. And we'll study it next class. But a typical bad motivation is, oh, all the other students are taking bodhisattva vows, I guess I should take bodhisattva vows. Very common and very bad. You're not supposed to do it for that reason. The other bad reason would be, I don't like that guy, and I want to look to be just as great a Buddhist as he is, and he took them, so I'm going to take them. So everybody knows I took them. You know? In other words, all these bad reasons. Oh, I'm going to die. I want to die with bodhisattva vows. That's a lower motivation. The real high motivation is, I want to take these vows, because if I keep them, I really can become enlightened, and then I'll really be able to help other people. That has to be the motivation. There's a lot of discussion in the text. It seems to be the position that if you don't have that motivation as you take them, they don't even form within you. You don't get them. Even if you're the only one who knows it. If in your own mind you're not doing it for the good of other people, they don't really form anyway. So that's the motivation you have. That protects you. If you don't take a vow to keep these rules, if you don't take a vow, you don't have this special kind of thought in your mind. You know something you could do that would hurt the person in the eyes of the boss or in somebody else's eyes, and you're just about to say that thing in front of everybody, and then you pull back because you say, I knelt before that lama, and I, in my mind, I swore that I would act for the good of every living being, and I'm about to hurt this person. You know, they'll make me the biggest liar in the world. You know, I swore that I would take on these vows, and I swore that I would now start to lead a kind of life where all I want is that other people be happy, even at my own expense. And then you're just about to hurt them and you stop because you remember the motivation you were supposed to have. That's called motza. Motza is where you pull back from a bad deed, from your own, what did we call it? I don't remember.
Reasons relating to yourself.
For reasons relating, for your own self-esteem. Nobody else knows what you're thinking at that moment. It's not for the purpose of other people's opinion of you. It's for your opinion of yourself. You avoid doing that thing in order to keep your own self-image in your own eyes. You know, that's not a worthy thing for me to do. I swore in front of that Lama. I mentally committed to helping all sentient beings, and here I am about to hurt someone just because they irritated me. And if you pull back, this is all taking place in your mind. Nobody else knows what's going on. That's Lhotse. And it takes place because of the motivation.
Translation.
Lhotse means, in when you're debating and you make a bad answer, they go, that means, aren't you ashamed of yourself? Isn't your face burning? Lhotse means face burning. It means to be ashamed, I guess. Or be ashamed. Conscience. Oh, conscience, I like, yeah. Because of your own conscience.
Yeah, what are you supposed to, like, what would you say would be a proper attitude if, like, you were attacked physically? Like, what would you say? Like, if you walk into work,
yeah,
and all of a sudden somebody comes and they're ready to stab you, but, I mean, do you have a right to defend yourself?
There's a point at
in
which
a way,
you,
like, you don't want to hurt the person, or, like, in a way that you would want, you know?
There's a point in Buddhist practice where you must stop somebody. You're required to stop somebody. There's a point in Buddhist practice where you can... You may have to use violent means. But you're never allowed to hate the person. You're never allowed to dislike the person. You know, you can do very strong means to stop a person. And that's allowed at a certain level. You're never allowed to dislike the person.
Right.
You know, so that's very subtle. You know, what a Lama would say is, you know, if you're capable of doing it and not hating the person.
Right.
But if all your motivation is like, there's a very famous case, the King Udayana, which Michael knows. He was an arhat. He had already achieved nirvana. His own son sent people to murder. He could read their minds. They met him on the road. They were trying to look nonchalant, you know. And he said, "You're here to murder me, right?" And they said, "Yeah." He says, "Give me a moment to meditate, all right? Then you would do whatever you have to do." So he went off to the side, and out of compassion for them, and out of compassion for them, there's many ways to stop a conflict without hurting anybody. And you have to get very good at it. Okay, pure motivation. Third one.
Michael, excuse me, you said these were four...
Four qualities of morality.
You said four benefits of the vows? Four benefits.
They're like four benefits of vowed morality.
So how is pure motivation a benefit?
By remembering the pure motivation you had as you took the vows, you are embarrassed to yourself to do something wrong.
I see.
That's one of the benefits of that. By remembering the... Yeah, you sat there and said, for the good of every living being. And then someone at work gets a very minor pleasure, and you get jealous of it. Okay, number three, fixable. The vows are fixable. If you break them, you can fix them. That's a great benefit of vows, right? It's a whole process. You will break your vows, and you have to learn how to restore them. And that quality is one of the great qualities of the vows. It's a way of life. You will fail at times. You can never get back to the original strength of the vows unless you take them over again. But so they're damaged, but you can restore them to a certain level. And that's a good quality of these vows. This kind of morality.
There is no karma for breaking a vow if
you can fix
it?
Oh, there's lots, very bad karma. We'll go over
that. Then what's there to fix? You can't.
No, you can restore the vow. You can.
Yeah.
And you can work on the karma of having broken it. That's a separate, those are two separate things. You can purify the karma. Have to try it. I could say in the first place, okay?
Did you say they weren't fully restorable? They were...
They're not as strong as you take
them. You can restore them by... It depends on which of the vows, and we'll go over it. For the root vows, you can take them over again. That's why it's good to go to the retreats every summer. Okay, don't break the vow in the first place. It's the fourth quality of morality. It's the fourth quality of vow morality. If these two elements are strong enough, you won't break the vow in the first place. Now, that's not exactly a benefit of Dhammarati, but that's one of the qualities of Dhammarati, is that if you're careful, you won't break it in the first place. If you have these two things very strong, one of the qualities of your personal morality will be that you won't break it in the first place. And those are the four. Those are from Asanga. Those are from Maitreya. Those are mentioned in the Bodhisattva Dhamma. Those are four qualities of morality. Four nice qualities.
Where are they mentioned?
In the levels of the Bodhisattva. It's a work by Maitreya. It's a work that Asanga, where Asanga summarized what he learned from Maitreya about morality and other Bodhisattva. Summarized it in about three volumes. It's huge. Let's see if I missed anything. That's what I just said. It's not very, we should say, a good quality. I mean, it's not really an advantage. And you know, in the normal sense that you think of it, it's called a yunten, gunnan, means a good quality. If you keep the first two of the four, you will gain the fourth advantage. How's that? It's like in the debate round. Sometimes you have to go around. Okay. Say tsatum.
Tsatum.
We're going to cover now the two, and that's, I think, the last thing we have to do. These are the two kinds of bodhisattva vows. I mentioned them briefly last class, but all the bodhisattva vows fall into one of two categories. There are the root vows, which are called tsatum. Tsa means root or primary. Tsa means root or primary. Dungwan literally means to fall down into a, off of a cliff, for example. Okay, into a canyon. I call it downfall sometimes. You can say root downfall. It means a major slip up. How's that? Okay, that's a tsatum. How many do you remember?
18.
And there are 18 major vows. These are the most heavy, karmically. Don't want to break them.
Are you saying that 18 downfalls or 18 vows?
The way they say main vow in Tibetan is major downfall. And actually, it's the breaking of the vow, right? But that's how they name them. Okay. It's a good point. Say nyeche.
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 Nyeche. Nyeche.
J means did, past tense, D-I-D. Nye means bad, did something bad. That's a secondary vowel. Okay, not as heavy karmically. How many?
46.
In the monk's vows, for example, there are five different categories of vowels. In the secret vowels, there are basically two categories and then a third subcategory. In the Bodhisattva vows, there's only two categories. All the vowels go into here or here. All of them. It's typical with vows of morality that there are certain categories, like if I break a root vow, like the first Bodhisattva vow, praising myself and putting down other people. Okay? If I do that, but not with a full kind of screwed up motivation, all right? If I do it somehow under some extenuating circumstances, it doesn't qualify as a root vow anymore. It actually becomes a secondary breaking of a vow. It has the power of one of these. It's still in this category. So for example, if I go out of control, or let's say if I'm crazy, let's say if I lose my sanity and I praise myself and put down somebody else, it's not, I do not break a root vow. It's not the power of breaking a root vow. It's the power of breaking a secondary vow. That's an example. If there are some kind of, we'll talk about it. There have to be four conditions present for me to really break a root vow. You have to have a heavy, heavy, bad thinking to break a root vow. If somehow that bad thinking is not all there, the power is of a secondary vow. And although the deed is in the root vows, you know, the action that you did, the karma of it is really a secondary vows karma. Much lighter. Much lighter. So when you're discussing the bodhisattva vows, you go through the root vows And then after that you say, by the way, but if you don't have a really screwed up state of mind when you do it, it's just the power of a secondary thought. All the texts say that. Now why is that a big deal? Why bring that up? It's to prove that there's only two categories of vows. Okay. So if I'm the homework, somebody said, prove that there's only two categories of bodhisattva vows. If you break one of these without the proper messed up motivation, the karma is only of a secondary vow. Why is that a big deal? Because after the vows were set down by the ancient Indian masters, a lot of people later started to make up different categories of vows. They're not valid, there's no authentic source for them, and Jetsam Kapa goes through this long explanation of why. And this is, you should know it. The texts only state two kinds of vows, and if you commit this one but without the right motivation, it becomes this one. So there's no other ones between.
So basically this is so that we can refute something that no longer exists.
There still exists in some Tibetan schools. It's still in some Tibetan schools.
Ah, okay.
And you can still see people making up things in Buddhism. You know? And we have to be very, very careful to stick to the, I mean, one purpose to have these classes is that, and one thing about Buddhism is the Buddha was omniscient. 2,500 years ago, he knew we'd have this class. He knew who would be in this class, and he knew every thought that you would have during this class, and every other thought you'd have during your whole life. You don't need to adjust what he taught. He taught what he taught to fit people in this room 2,500 years later, perfectly. And it does fit us perfectly. We don't need in our lifetime to modify it to keep up with the new age, you know? It's totally perfect, and it's just right for us. And the whole purpose, one of the reasons of having a class is to make sure that we pass it on to the next generation in its pure form, and we don't go messing around with it. So that's one reason to talk about why there's only two categories. So
we had examples in last week about that the sutras came, that the sutras, the examples we had were about the root vows. Are the sutras the secondary vows?
Yeah, they're all in the Protection and Wisdom Sutra.
All
yeah,
and
but all spread out.
Okay.
All right, one more point. Yes, sir.
If you do a secondary vow breaking without full motivation, do you have a less than secondary vow?
Yeah. No. Less karma. There's only two categories. That's another reason why there's only two categories. All right, last point. The last point you'll get from your reading. It's the last thing in your reading. But Jetsam Kapa spends a long time in the reading talking about, in his day and in our day also, people teaching, they have a big course, they give a big initiation to a bunch of naive Americans, although Americans are becoming less naive and it's harder to do this nowadays. And they say, I just gave you a big tantric initiation, you are now tantric followers. And we're going to have a good time after that. We're having a party, and we're going to do some weird things. And this is going to be tantric practice, okay? And you don't have to worry about those old moralities. Now you're above all those, okay? You now have a tantric initiation, and you don't have to worry about monk's morality, or those 10 moralities, or bodhisattva morality. We're above all that now. You're now on a higher level. Come to my place afterwards, especially the pretty dress. it was very popular for a while, and then Americans, now you go to Russia or other countries where Buddhism is just reaching, you know, that gang all moved over there, because now the Americans understand too much about Buddhism to go for that. But Jetsam Kapa goes into a long explanation why. Don't fall into this very big mistake. He says, you know, The bodhisattva vows are based on your other morality. You're a fool if you say, I'm going to keep bodhisattva vows and I don't need that normal morality anymore. And you're a double fool if you think you can keep your secret vows and you think you don't need your bodhisattva vows anymore or your monk's vows or your layman's vows. Okay. He says, in fact, it's so beautiful. He goes into a beautiful page where he compares that idea to a hailstorm. If you've ever been in a Kansas or Iowa where there's corn all over and a real good hailstorm comes. I was in one about 2 weeks ago. It hurts. I mean, it's big stones. and they fall down and they wipe out the whole field. The whole field is just shattered pieces of stalks all over the ground. Nothing standing anymore. You know, like one or two and the whole field left. He says that concept that you take some kind of higher vows and you can throw away your lower vows is like a hailstorm that destroys the happiness of all people. You know, if you wanted to screw up the happiness of the people around you, teach them that idea. If you want to assure that they are miserable for many, many years, and that they never reach any kind of happiness, teach them that idea. Because then they'll just really mess up their lives. You know, he gives a very beautiful, so it's in there. And you should read it, it's on your homework, okay? You know, what's Jetsun Kapa's reaction to this idea? And it's very strong. You cannot take the Bodhisattva vows. You must be grounded in the other 10 vows. You don't have to take a lifetime vow. Better if you do. And when you get your tantra vows, you must keep your Bodhisattva vows in there. And your regular morality. Or it doesn't work at all. It will never work. It'll just make you miserable. Worse than that, it will take you to the lower realm. I mean, after you die, it will have horrible, horrible things happen. So don't go for that, all right? All right, we'll do a prayer and then...